And good morning and welcome to this April 19th, 2000 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. And we are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you information on how to access those later in the hour. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. And today we're going to travel a bit. I don't know about you, but one of my favorite things about reading fiction is the ability to travel, to, experience other cultures and other times and other countries, especially the ones that probably realistically I might not get to experience in reality. And so I chose two of those for today. We are going to be going to Colombia and to South Korea. I'm excited this morning to welcome Eugene Grace Wirtz to the show this morning. She's joining me now. And in the second half, I'll chat with debut novelist Julianne Pacheco about her novel and stories, The Lucky Ones. Eugene Grace Wirtz was born in Seoul, South Korea, and immigrated to the U.S. at age 6. She holds a B.A. in English from Yale University and an M.F.A. in fiction from NYU. Everything Belongs to Us is her first novel. It's published by Random House, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Grace, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. This was a huge treat. I always read debut novelists with the richness of the story, the richness of the characters, the richness of the setting, and knock out language. And I'm like, man, how long did it take her to write that? That's really good.
Thank you so much.
How long did it take you to write this?
Well, the actual writing, I would say, took me about 3 years. But if I were being truthful, probably much longer than that in terms of germination and thought process. And before this, I had written another novel, which in some ways was sort of the prequel to this novel. And that novel, the first novel that I ever wrote, did not sell. But I took a character from that first novel and rewound 40 years or 30 years into that character's youth and became a historical fiction novel.
That's crazy. So before we talk too much in detail about it, we can let our listeners in on the secret of what the novel is about. I'm going to let you introduce us and kind of take us into it, take us into this world and introduce us to these characters.
Sure. So the novel's called Everything Belongs to Us, and it's about college students, so freshmen and sophomores, 18 and 19-year-olds at an elite university in South Korea, and the University of Seoul National University, which is the premier university of Korea. And at that time, as well as now, if you were to gain admission into SNU, you would more or less be guaranteed a successful future. You could become a business leader or a government official or top of your field in medicine. So it was, especially at the time that I'm writing about in 1978, which was sort of a turning point in South Korean contemporary history, a way for young people to grab onto the socioeconomic changes happening in the country and to catapult themselves as well as the country into prosperity.
Very cool. You know, it strikes me that some novels hit at just the right time. And of course, there's a lot of international attention right now on Korea. I mean, specifically North Korea, but really a lot of international attention on South Korea. And I always think that you have to think about the context in which a novel is born into, you know, that it doesn't exist kind of out in space. It comes into the world at a particular time. And I thought, what an interesting time for this novel to be born into the world when I think a lot of Americans are fascinated by this culture and you know, trying to learn as much as they can about Korea, the Korean mindset. And I was wondering if you could just spend a couple of minutes kind of talking about the big kind of cultural differences between the U.S. and Korea. I feel like Korea is much more community oriented, that there's like the spirit of children being raised in a village more than in individual families, that women serve kind of a collective role. And I was wondering if you just talk a little bit about the big cultural differences that we should be aware of.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, I think I was incredibly fortunate in some ways because I started this novel 5 years ago. And when I started writing the novel, I had hoped oh, you know, by the time this novel comes out into the world, if it comes out into the world, it would seem timely. And it absolutely has, because as we know, the South Korean president was impeached by almost like a nationwide moratorium in December of 2016, and then was unanimously approved by the courts in March. And so she's the daughter of the president that I'm writing about in my novel. And in many cases, people think of her as sort of the closing bookend to the opening bookend that her father started in the country. And as you mentioned, for me, you know, Korean culture has always been relevant because I was born there and I was raised in a very traditional Korean household. And the title, Everything Belongs to Us, I always focus on the word us, because it is a very communal culture. It is a culture that is focused on the we and the us more so than the I. Mm-hmm. And growing up as an American child, because I came here as a six-year-old and did the majority of my growing up here in the States, I was taught to think in terms of I, as most American children are. Mm-hmm. And when I came home, it was a completely different mindset, because whatever you do as an individual in the Korean mindset not only reflects on yourself, which is kind of a drop in the bucket is your family, your parents, your nationality, and even as a Korean-American child, I was always taught that my actions were reflecting on Koreans, you know, the diaspora of Koreans outside of Korea, but also Koreans in Korea. So that mindset of always reflecting on the group has absolutely been a part of my consciousness.
Very interesting, very interesting. And it's funny because there's such a, so it takes place in the 1970s, which in the U.S. was a very, you know, exploratory time, sexually
right.
exploratory and drugs and whatever else exploratory.
Coming off the 60s.
Yeah, yep. Coming off the 60s, right. And, you know, my sense of Korea was, as from the novel, is certainly not that way. It felt much more modest and, you know, I was wondering if you could talk, kind of talk to that, the difference between the U.S. in the 70s and Korea in the 70s.
Right. And this is part of why I became so fascinated in this time period, because, you know, as a child, I was aware of the Korean War, and then I was aware of my own history, which I was born in 1980. So by the 80s, South Korea seemed in many ways very similar to the United States, and I was not aware of the political differences. But unbeknownst to me, there are huge political differences, because South Korea did not become a true democracy until the late 80s. And so the president of South Korea, Park Chung-hee, was in power from 1961 until 1979, when he was assassinated. And so that the 60s and 70s, the post-war decades, were coming off of a time of extreme poverty. So 1953, when the war ended in Korea, both North and South Korea were among the most impoverished countries in the world, which is incredibly difficult to think about in the context of modern South Korea. Modern South Korea is among the most developed and probably top 12, top 15 most prosperous nations in the world. But, in, you know, 60 years ago, it was scraping the bottom of the barrel in terms of international position. And so the generation that came after the war, which is my parents' generation, they were born in 53 and 54, they were responsible for transforming the country. And so in some ways, they're coming off of a very militaristic culture, coming out of the war, coming out of poverty, and facing the West for the first time, because as we know, North Korea was backed by USSR and South Korea was backed by the United States. And so for the first time, the West was a tremendous influence overtly on South Korea. And so the alliance politically, economically, socially made a tremendous impact. But it took, I would say, at least two generations for that cultural opening to take place. So in the 70s, Korea was still very much a very ultra-conservative society. As I mentioned in some scenes in my book, you know, middle schoolers and high schoolers would have almost no friends or interaction with the opposite sex because they were in single-sex schools, wearing military uniforms at school, and dating was not considered even an appropriate activity unless you were already in college, so 19 and higher. And at that point, you were expected to not date but court, you know, find a partner, find a marriage partner right away. So a very, very different point of view from what I was raised to consider normal in the West, you know, in New Jersey in the 80s and 90s. And so it was very interesting to me to understand that this is the way that my parents were raised and what they were, you know, conditioned to believe was normal.
Right, right. So I have read through your interviews that one of the characters is based heavily on your mom and your mom's experience. And I'd love for you to talk about that, about mining character, about accessing these women, the two very different women from two very different backgrounds, and kind of bringing these women to life. Can you talk about those characters?
Sure. So the character Nami in my novel, who is the daughter of a poor family, and she's the younger daughter who has a great academic gift and is sort of burdened in some ways to lift her family out of poverty by going to SNU and becoming a doctor and finding that prosperous future that would help them all. And it was based on my mom because she was a very academically gifted student who was always interested in reading and literature, and so she tested into an elite middle school and the elite high school, and finally into Iwa Women's University, which is one of the I would say an elite university in South Korea. And so for her, it was not necessarily about launching her family out of poverty, but just expressing her natural talents in a way that created privilege in a life that she didn't have a lot of privilege to begin with. And so for a long time, I actually was not aware that my mom had overcome so many difficulties in terms of socioeconomic barriers. And when I learned that as like a teenager or in my early 20s, she explained to me how she had felt ashamed of her poverty as a child and as a young person growing up, because in Korea it was very much a stigma. And in my point of view, and I think for most American points of view, overcoming extreme poverty to make something of yourself and to use your natural talents and work hard and apply that to success is like the classic American rags to riches story. I mean, not that my mom achieved, you know, the riches necessarily, but I was very proud when I found that out about her, and I was really moved and felt that that was a compelling story. And I had to have conversations with her to explain, like, wow, mom, that's amazing. That's great. You know, I'm so proud of you. And I remember she started tearing up and crying when I said that, because she thought, wow, you know, I didn't tell my daughter this for decades because I thought that this was something to be ashamed of, not something to be proud of.
So interesting. It's interesting that you've talked about this novel being kind of an act of healing between you and your mom, and maybe between you and both of your parents. And I think that's so interesting, because so often, especially if people write memoir, it really tears relationships apart. And so the ability for a novel to bring empathy and understanding onto two people that maybe you didn't fully understand before, by having to inhabit these characters and really almost having to inhabit your younger version of your mom and go through the experiences that she went through in, you know, this need to really, really deeply understand what it was like for her, is so cool. It's so cool that brought you guys closer.
Yeah, it was a byproduct of writing that I never imagined was going to happen. And in some ways, it is absolutely the primary result that I'm proud of. You know, this this book. I worked on it, like I said, for many years, and I'm so thrilled that it was published by Random House. And, you know, in many ways, there are things that I consider achievements about having this novel out in the world. But what really brings me joy is that when I started this book, it was because I was intellectually fascinated by the history of South Korea that I had not been aware of, which was so immediate to my family's history and to my upbringing. But in the process, like you mentioned, of inhabiting these characters who are essentially contemporaries of my parents and who are built out of my imagination, but built out of their recollections and their remembrances of what the culture was like at the time, it just made me realize, like, if I'm having so much empathy and so much understanding and such a sense of kinship with these characters that are figments of my imagination, I absolutely should extend that same courtesy and love to my parents, who are real people and who actually created me, like, as a real person, not just as a figment of their imagination. And so it created such a wealth of gratitude that I had not been able to access before, and it created such a sense of, like, appreciation for what they had gone through in their lives, which is clearly so much more tumultuous and so much more adaptation than I ever probably will have to face in my lifetime.
Yeah. So interesting. Let's hope so. Let's hope.
Yes, I mean, now it seems like I might have to face some tumultuous things, right? with our current political climate, but I'm crossing my fingers that that's not the case.
Yeah, we all are. You're tuned into Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Grace Wertz. The book is Everything Belongs to Us. Kind of dovetailing on that, I know that you had expressed some trepidation about historical fiction and writing about historical fiction, and you know, I think everything that we've been talking about kind of speaks to the path that led you to feel confident enough to write. You know, it's so funny for me to talk about a historical novel being set in the 70s, because that's when I was born. So it pains me to say it's historical fiction, but it did take place in a different time period. Talk about some of the difficulties of making that decision to do historical fiction, the amount of research that it took, how you went about that, and kind of how you got yourself comfortable enough to feel confident enough to write about a time period you didn't live through.
Right. And in some ways, it pains me, too, to say that this is historical fiction, because I was born in 1980. So this being said in 1978, it's only 2 years before I was born. And so it's a double-edged sword, because the history to me is still quite live. But I recognize that it's 40 years, which is a significant period, especially in modern times. And so part of my anxiety and insecurity was that not only was this a time period I had not lived through, it was a country that I felt that, you know, I haven't lived as a full-time resident of Korea since 1986, and the politics of Korea is not as instinctively or intuitive to me as the politics of the United States is. And so I wanted very fervently to do it justice and to make sure that if an American read this, that it would seem authentic, and very much more so that if a Korean or a Korean American read this, particularly an older Korean American who is of my parents' generation, read this, it would feel authentic. And so I read everything I could get my hands on the topic that was written in English, and I was very lucky, because I think that the 1970s in South Korea has become a topic of scholarly research in the post-millennial years, because people have become very interested in young democracies and nation building, and particularly how grassroots movements create national identity. And so one of the themes in this book that I spent a lot of time researching was the labor protest movement and the movement for democracy. And the two groups that were primarily responsible for bringing labor justice and democracy to South Korea were factory workers, labor unions, and also students in universities. And so I read what I could in English, and then once I had what I felt was a strong intellectual background, I interviewed all my family members and cornered them at every single family gathering that I could, and you know, peppered them with questions about, you know, what were you wearing in the 70s? What were people listening to in terms of music? You know, what films were they playing, whether they were domestic films or foreign films? And what were the dating relationships like? And what did people do for fun? And I really wanted to get a sense of the youth culture because I wanted, even though this is a historical fiction novel, I wanted for it to have a contemporary feel and for American readers to be able to make that leap, that the huge shifts in culture and politics and socioeconomic justice that are happening in this country are applicable to some of the things that are that happened in a country halfway around the world 40 years ago.
Right, right. I should mention that there are some really wonderful photographs on your website. I can't remember which tab you have to press on, but there's some great...
For readers, I think.
Yeah, for readers, right, right. That really kind of bring this visually to life as well, although the novel does such a great job of bringing it visually to life. But it was fun to flip through those pictures and see your family and your mom, and that was great.
Yeah, that was really fun for me, too, because thank God they took those photos, and thank God they're so photogenic.
Yeah, right. Very photogenic. Right, right. Do you speak Korean?
I do. So I came to the States when I was 6, and so I had already, you know, learned to read and write. And growing up in my family, my parents were intensely aware of how American culture would influence our futures. And so they made sure that we spoke only Korean at home, and we went to Korean school on the weekends, and we went to a Korean church on Sunday, and all our friends pretty much were other Korean immigrant families. And so I very much lived in what I consider like Korea America, not mainstream America.
Yeah.
And so by the time I went to college as a 19-year-old or as an 18-year-old, it was like entering America for the first time in some ways. You know, going to the dining halls and seeing food that we never ate at home, and, you know, eating with a fork and knife for the first time every day. Like, these were all very, like, novel experiences for me, even though by that time I had been in the country, you know, 12-odd years. So it's interesting, and I'm sure many other immigrant kids have the same experience, that you might be physically growing up in America, but in your home it's, you know, India, America, or, you know, Bolivia, America. It's very much a different world when you step through your front door.
Right. Well, one of the things that struck me about the novel is the richness of the language, the richness of the descriptions. And I always think bilingual writers or trilingual writers have an edge up because they have a whole nother language to draw from, even if you can't physically use the language in the book. You know, like Eskimos have 1,000 words for snow. You just have a more expansive worldview when you speak another language. And I was wondering if you thought your bilingualism informs your English when you're writing. Does that make sense?
It does. And I find it fascinating to read about other writers like Yi-Yun Lee or Alexander Hemin, who, like, both of them came to America as adults and then chose to write in English, and for me it's slightly different because I didn't come to American as an adult, and English is now my more fluent language by far. But I think that because English is not my only language, and because I'm always having an undercurrent of Korean language, if not Korean thought, in my mind, I'm having different possibilities from which to choose different words or different emotions or different cultural points of views, and I find that to be a strength. I find that to be something I appreciate deeply, but also I think that was a hurdle for me as a beginning writer, and something that I didn't know that I would have to overcome. I always say when I started attempting to write fiction. I was 23 years old, and I was in a PhD program for English literature at UC Berkeley, and that was the closest I felt that I could get to literature because I knew I wanted to live a life in books, and I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll be a professor of literature. And when I realized that that wasn't really what I wanted to actually write the fiction myself, it took me a long time to realize that the characters that I would have to write about were Koreans or Korean Americans, because the literature that I had steeped myself in were mostly the Western canon and characters who were white or, you know, male or white males. And so I did not even realize that that was a block for me. And when I realized, like, wow, you know, it would be very difficult for me to write about only white people or only Americans in my stories, because my mind and my heart and my imagination are populated by Koreans and Korean Americans in addition to Americans. And so I needed to, in some ways, give myself permission to write about Koreans and Korean Americans in English, because that's not something that I had studied or, you know, felt was like second nature to me.
Yeah, right, right. So interesting. Oh, it's killing me. We're drawing down on our time, and I have 100 more questions, but such is the nature of these things. Through the course of writing this, because it's your debut novel, and I know there was another novel before this that wasn't published, can you give us advice that you've garnered, things you learned along the way that might help new novelists, especially if novelists are writing about other cultures, if they grew up in another culture? But anything, really anything you've learned along the way that that you would pass along as good advice?
I would say the first bit of advice that was the most eye-opening for me is what I just was coming off of, which is if you are someone that has stories about non-white or non-mainstream cultures, you have to develop a language to describe those situations that feels natural and authentic to your experience. And so I always say to myself, be the writer that I am, not the writer that I think I should be. And the way I adapted that advice is because I'm a new mom. My son's going to be 2 this summer, and I saw this on a parenting blog, of all things. And somebody had said, be the parent who you are, not the parent who you think you should be. And I applied that to writing as well. We all have aspirational ideas, I think, of what is great art and what is a proper story. And I think that the American literary landscape is wrestling with that on a pretty major scale these days, of what stories are privileged and what stories should have the mainstream attention. And for me, personally, it was a journey to be able to tell stories that I didn't necessarily see in mainstream media. And so I would encourage people who have experiences that they don't necessarily see, find a way to tell that story in a way that feels perfectly natural, whether it's funny, whether it's tragic, whether it's quirky. We desperately need those stories, and I'm so thrilled that this is a larger dialogue that we're having.
I love it. I love it. Grace Wartz, this was wonderful. Everything Belongs to Us is the book. We can find you online. You have a great, great website. This was such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Maria. I really appreciate this conversation.
Thank you. That was Grace Wartz, the book Everything Belongs to Us. It's out and published by Random House. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Julianne Pacheco will be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes or under College Radio, or you can find us on Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. Guess what? The LA Times Book Festival is coming up this weekend up in LA. So hopefully our local listeners are all going to that. Barbara, I think, is in conversation with George Saunders about his audio book. But a lot of great speakers up there every single year. So that is not to be missed if you are in this area. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Julianne Pacheco grew up in Cali, Colombia, and lived there until she was 18. She's currently completing a PhD in creative writing at the University of East Anglia in England. She's calling in from England, which is so cool. Her short story, Honey Bunny, appeared in The New Yorker, loved it then, and loved it rereading it now. And two of her stories have been anthologized in Best British Short Stories 2015. The Lucky Ones is her first novel in short stories. It's published by Spiegel & Grau, a division of Random House. Julianne, welcome.
You there? Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on all the way from England. I love this.
Yes, isn't technology amazing? I'm about 20 minutes away from Stonehenge, and I'm talking to you in Irvine.
Isn't that cool? I love it. So I really enjoyed the first thing that struck me about this book. I kept turning back to the cover because it said a novel, and then I'd read it, and I'm like, "Well, is it really a novel? It feels like linked short stories to me." But you know, that can be a form of the novel. But I would love for you to take us inside of this, talk about novel versus linked short stories, and kind of how these stories came about. Kind of take us into your world in Colombia.
Definitely. So I knew from the very beginning that I didn't want to write like a traditional novel. I started writing this book when I was taking a master's course in creative writing at the University of East Anglia. And so for the week, you know, for the biweekly workshop submissions, myself and a lot of other people, it seemed like we just kind of ended up writing short stories because it was sort of an easier form to have people to read and comment on. So I think from very early on, I knew that I wanted to write a book that was sort of strange and that wasn't really a short story collection and wasn't really a novel either. And I guess a lot of the books that I personally really enjoy reading are also sort of a hybrid of both forms. Like I really loved A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, Ghost Written by David Mitchell. I also really love this book by this Irish writer, Keith Ridgway, called Hawthorne and Child. So I guess it's a bit of a cliche, but I suppose I ended up writing the kind of book that I personally enjoy reading. And then it also felt like an honest way to write about Colombia as well and sort of my experiences growing up there and sort of acknowledging its very violent, turbulent history. And so with that all in mind, Colombia is still a country that's very much fragmented, but still trying to come together. And so in a way, I like the idea of writing a book that's also kind of fragmented and isn't really complete, because that's sort of what Colombia feels like to me.
I love that. Yeah, I heard you say that in another interview, and I thought that was so brilliant of a way for the form to reflect the subject. Was really, really wonderful. And all of these characters, all of the stories ended on sort of this uncertain note. You know, we kind of don't know that the characters are safe, kind of don't know what, and it, which is how short stories go. But yeah, I mean, not having experienced Colombia did feel so authentic to the place.
Yeah, and that was important to me, too, to not have every character's fate be explained. And when the book was actually being edited, my U.S. editor, you know, she would ask, like, oh, like, well, what happened to this character? Like, maybe we should be more specific about what, you know, exactly ended up to her. And so even though I know that me not giving those kinds of answers might frustrate some readers, you know, I guess I was just sort of okay with that frustration. Because I guess I like reading books that are maybe sort of challenging and difficult. Like, I don't like reading books where I feel like all the answers are given to me.
I completely agree with you. And it's true to life. I mean, how do we know how anybody ends up, right?
For sure, yeah.
I thought it would be helpful for you to spend just a little bit of time talking about not necessarily your personal experiences in Colombia, but talking about Colombia in general, because I feel like it's such a charged word in the U.S. It feels like there's all this electricity around it. And I thought we should probably demystify some of the, you know, it's just violence and drugs to Americans. And I thought it's good to get the other side, and this book kind of offered some of the other side.
For sure, yeah. I mean, I know there's been this really successful show on Netflix, like the Narcos show,
right?
The one about like Pablo Escobar, and like in a way, having that show come out has been, you know, from kind of like a selfish, cynical viewpoint, it's sort of helpful for me because it's sort of. Yep. Made Colombia familiar to people who would maybe otherwise not know. I think people in the States are sort of more familiar with Colombia than people here in England are. But I think Colombia's reputation, like the reputation it had in the 80s, 90s, being sort of like this very unstable, like very dangerous place, I don't know. I feel like that's maybe kind of like faded over time. I mean, I remember when I was, you know, in high school in Colombia and like seeing this German backpacker tourist for the first time. I was just shocked because I had just never seen a foreign tourist before. It was just really surprising to me. But now I hear about people traveling to Colombia all the time, right?
Yeah.
I feel like definitely like in the past decade, it's gotten safer and that people are more into traveling there. And I guess like with the book, you know, I didn't really want to write a book that was sort of like a narco narrative, like a cartel book. Even though there are some elements of that in a few stories, I mean, a lot of the stories are also just about friendship or about just like growing up. You know, just being children or being teenagers. And I guess that was, like, important for me to show, too. Like, I remember having one person tell me, like, oh, like, I can't believe you have characters who are, like, listening to music, like, listening to American bands. And I just thought that was just a strange comment because I was like, well, why wouldn't they, you know? Like, because you're a teenager there, too, you know? So that was, like, important to me to not just have the book be about sort of like destabilizing institutional violence, but also just sort of show like the everyday lives of the characters.
Yeah, exactly. And you are bilingual. We were talking about this in the first half hour. What a gift I think it is. I'm not bilingual, but what a gift it feels like it is from a reader's perspective to have the whole history of language, of another language behind your writing, because it feels like it makes your English so much richer, that your descriptions are so much more vivid because you're drawing from, even if it's not the literal Spanish words, it's kind of the, you know, the whole literary, new descriptions or new ways to see things.
For sure, yeah. And actually when I was writing the book, it was really interesting because I would initially use sort of like Spanish words or sort of like Colombian terms within the book. Like there's a phrase I use a lot in the book where I just talk about somebody's ranch or somebody's farm. And so the Colombian word you would use for that would be finca, right? Which is sort of this very common word that everyone would know. But then when I was editing the book, I had it suggested to me that, you know, you have some writers like Juno Diaz where they're of like Spanish and English is sort of like very like rich and like really sort of brings the stories alive on the page. But I was presented with the question of like, well, why would the characters, if they're speaking in Spanish all the time, like in the stories, like why would they sometimes, like why would sometimes the phrases be translated and sometimes not, right? So I made this decision to not have any Spanish phrases in the book. I think there's only one, mijo, which is sort of an abbreviation for mi hijo, like my son, because I felt like that couldn't really be translated accurately. And I still sometimes think about that where I'm just like, was that really like the good decision to make? Like, wouldn't it have been nice to sort of have some sort of, you know, Colombian expressions or phrases in there? But maybe for the next book, I'll keep that in mind more.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. How much it adds to it. But I feel like even if you're only using English words, just the way you would see something, the way you would experience heat or the way you would experience, I don't know, anything, would still have the richness of that language, you know, that you could bring to bear and find an even more interesting English word, you know, to use to describe
it. For sure. Yeah, and definitely something that really helped me write the book was to read a lot of books about Colombia, both translated and not translated. I actually read a lot of nonfiction and a lot of journalism about Colombia, and that was really helpful for me because I was writing this book when I was in England. So, you know, it was sort of nice to have a source that wasn't just sort of my biased, subjective childhood memories.
Yeah.
So that was like really helpful for me too.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about writing about it when you weren't there and if that distance kind of mm-hmm. helped you. Because I think sometimes getting away from something makes you see it a little bit clearer.
Yeah, I've met so many writers who say that, where, you know, they lived in China or they lived in Japan or, you know, their childhood homes, that they couldn't really write about them until they left. And I remember during my master's degree, I asked one of my tutors, I said, oh, do you think it would be a good idea for me to go back to Colombia to do research? And he was just very emphatic about saying, no, I don't think that's a good idea at all. Huh. And I think he was right, because I think having that distance and having that perspective is liberating in a way. But I think, like, for my next book, I do plan on going back, but that's sort of for, like, a specific research trip.
Uh-huh.
So I suppose it depends on sort of the intentions and the goals of each book. But for me personally, for this first book, I think having that distance was helpful.
Do you think writing about it changed the way you think about it? Because I always feel like, you know, every time you have a memory, it kind of changes the reality of what the experience was having.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, I wonder if distilling it through writing really changes the way you originally thought about it.
You know, I think, like, someone else has asked me that question, and I think I still have the same answer, which is I still don't really know. I mean, I was just in Colombia in 2015 when I had just finished the draft that got sent to publishers. And I mean, every time I go back there, it just feels the same, you know? It just, like, reminds me, it's just my childhood home, right? I was talking to this Colombian journalist recently where he asked me, like, a similar question of, like, oh, what would you say Cali is to you, like the city where I grew up? Like, how would you describe your relationship to Cali now? And the best metaphor I could come up with was saying, oh, well, you know, it's sort of like having a friend on Facebook that you've, like, your childhood friend on Facebook, and even though you haven't really spoken in a long time and you don't see each other that much, you know that when you do see each other, you just go back to square one, to, like, where you were before.
Uh-huh.
And you just always have that connection that never really fades.
Uh-huh. I get it. I like that.
Mm.
This is why I purposely don't go back to my childhood home.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel really lucky that I have Google Maps. Like, I use Google Maps to look at the house where I grew up in. And apparently it's been turned into this, like, evangelical Christian community center. And there's this giant wall around it. And in a way, I was like, well, I'm glad I got to see this on the internet, so I don't have to, like, go in person, like,
that's
see
so great.
This giant, like, wall around my childhood home.
Right.
But, you know, my mother, she grew up in South Africa, and my father and her once went to go visit her childhood home, and she refused to get out of the car. She just didn't want to do it, and I completely sympathize with her because, in a way, you don't really want to have that memory displaced, you know?
Yeah, right. No, I sympathize with that, too. That makes total mm-hmm. sense to me. My guest this morning is Julianne Pacheco. The book is The Lucky Ones. I was wondering if we could take a story. We can take any story, but
mm-hmm.
I loved Lemon Pie. Lemon Pie was one of my favorites. But you can choose any story. And we can kind mm-hmm. of deconstruct the story to go from, like, the original kernel of the idea to and
mm-hmm.
what the point of entry was and the door in, and then to kind of what it became and kind of your process
mm-hmm.
for unpacking one of these.
Oh, my gosh, what a fun question. That's, like, a really good question to, like, ask a writer, because I feel like writers really enjoy talking about themselves and their process, their creative process sometimes. So I think I will talk about Lemon Pie just because that was a really fun story
yeah.
to write about.
Yeah.
So the initial idea I got for that story was I was reading this nonfiction book about people who had been kidnapped and held hostage in the jungle in Colombia for many years. And there was an anecdote in that book about a Colombian lawyer who'd been held in isolation, which is a bit rare because, like, sometimes usually they hold you in a camp with other people. And so this lawyer was so bored from being held in captivity alone for so long, he began teaching law classes to the surrounding trees in the camp. And I just thought that was a really interesting image, and it really stuck with me of, like, well, what would it be like to just have nothing to do with your time? Like, what kind of things would your brain come up in order to occupy yourself? So that was sort of the initial spark. And then I also read this really interesting memoir about people who'd been held captive in Beirut, in Lebanon, in the 80s. It was such a good book. I wish I could remember the title. But that was also sort of like a similar theme of, like, people who were being held captive for very long periods of time and didn't have ways to amuse themselves. So I knew that I wanted to write a story that was a captivity narrative that was about someone being held captive in Colombia. And it was a story that took me a very long time to figure out how to write, because it was difficult to decide what perspective to use. You know, like, first I was writing from the perspective of one of the guards, and then I was writing from the perspective of a Colombian senator. And the problem with that was that neither of those voices sounded very realistic. And so once I sort of hit upon the voice of an American expat middle school teacher who taught English, then that really helped me figure out the story, because it meant I could write about things that I enjoyed and felt confident writing about. Like, he develops this obsession with the Aliens films. He has a lot of fun teaching Hamlet, which is like a play that I really enjoyed being taught in middle school. So I think that was something that really helped me figure the story out. I mean, is it okay if I ask you, like, what did you think was interesting about the story? Like, when
you read
it? Well,
that very, you know, when, as it started revealing itself, that I now realized what the situation he was in and he's talking to. And he had such an earnest relationship with the rocks and the branches, you know, that he really clearly imbued them with personalities, because which showed how lonely he was and how isolated he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they're chaining him to the bed for no reason. It turns out there was a reason, but, you know, from his perspective, we didn't know that. And so his intelligence combined with his kind of confusion and his need to hold on to, I think when people are kept in solitary confinement, what they do to keep themselves sane of, you know, remembering what life was like before they were in this position is so powerful. You know, I mean, this story was just such an act of empathy for me to really inhabit this horrible situation.
Yeah, that's, like, really interesting to hear. Like, I read a lot of journals and sort of firsthand accounts by people who've been kept in captivity. Like, one book that was really useful to me was actually a book that was written by a man who was one of my parents' coworkers, like someone that they were working with in the 80s. And he kept a journal during the time that he was held captive. And then this journal was used as the basis of a film adaptation, which was called Proof of Life. It came out in, like, 2001, and it was, like, starring, like, Russell Crowe and Meg Ryan. I think it was, like, a totally different story than what he wrote about. But something you really notice when you read these sort of journals and firsthand accounts is just, like, the repetitiveness. And, like, they're so boring. We're just day in and day out. It's the same thing.
Yeah,
I mean, another experience that was really useful to me was I went on this 10-day meditation retreat where you had to be silent for 10 days. And, oh, my gosh, that was actually really helpful for me, too, because you, I just spent so long just like staring at like spider webs, just like watching insects because you're just so bored. So, I mean, I just think the human mind is so fascinating. And like the initial draft of the story was over 20,000 words long. It was almost like a novella. And it's still, I think it's the longest story in the book. I think it's around like 8,000 words now.
Wow.
So, but I ended up cutting it down because initially, like I wanted to really bring out the boredom and the repetitiveness in the story, but then as a consequence of that, it was just kind of boring,
it's hard
you know?
To read. Yeah, right, right.
So,
no, that really came through. I think that really came through. And then that, you know, the texture of the title is so different. It just adds another dimension to the story, which is, you know, it seems so light and happy.
Yeah, I find naming stories really difficult. And like someone, a friend of mine was telling me like, oh, like you have such an obsession with candy and like sweet things in this book where there's a story called Honey Bunny. There's a story called Behind the Cake. There's
M&M's.
A story called M plus M, like the candy. And I was just like, oh my gosh, you're right.
Yeah, right.
I don't really know what's up with that.
Yeah, I love how the subconscious, we're running out of time, but I love how the subconscious works, you know, that if you get out of your own way, what bubbles up from your subconscious is great, you know. If you kind of organize the story, but then you let your subconscious play, and there's a lot of wordplay in this book that's so wonderful that we didn't get to talk about, but yeah, it is, it's that's the pleasure. It's the pleasure for both probably the writer and the reader. It's great.
I agree.
Where do we find you online? Can we stalk you as I have been doing?
Oh, of course. So I have a website, which is my name, juliannepacheco.com. I'm updating it today, though, so it might be down for a while.
Okay, good, good.
But I also have a Twitter account, which is also my name, at Julianne Pacheco. So that's the best way for people to stay in touch with me.
Wonderful. Well, this was so wonderful. I can't wait for your next one. This was,
thank you. And I just have to say that I was very excited about being invited to do this interview because my father grew up in Orange County.
You're kidding. Well, you're all over the world.
I know. Well, he grew up all over California, but he went to high school in Costa Mesa.
Oh my gosh.
And I was just talking to him and he was saying, oh yeah, you know, we would play basketball against Anaheim and Irvine, and they would always beat us because their teams were so good.
That's hilarious.
And I was just like, wow.
Wow.
What a good anecdote for me to share on the radio.
I love it. Well, Julianne, congratulations on the huge success. This is an awesome, awesome book. That was Julianne Pacheco. The book is The Lucky Ones. It is out and available now. It is really, really a great it's just great. It's a wonderful other side of Colombia. If you're watching the Escobar show on Netflix, you really need to read this so that you get the full perspective of Colombia. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Stay tuned for Kaleidoscope Days coming up next. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day.